from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next in this morning's forum, will Turkey invade Iraq or will diplomacy bring resolution to the conflict between Turkey and the Kurdish rebels who are based in northern Iraq? And what is the stake of the United States with its obvious deep ongoing concern over this crisis? We'll discuss recent events involving Turkey and the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party, and get updates and in-depth analysis. The hour will include your calls and emails, and we begin after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Tens of thousands of Turks have taken to the streets to protest cross-border attacks by Kurdish rebels based in Kurdish-controlled northern Iraq. Armed rebels in the Marxist-Leninist Guerrilla Kurdistan Workers Party, or the PKK, have killed a minimum of 42 over the past month, including 30 ambushed Turkish soldiers. And yesterday, Turkey hit rebel positions in the southeast province of Terseli, killing an estimated 15 PKK rebels. Turkey has massed 100,000 troops on the frontier against some 3,000 PKK guerrillas, and Turkey began aerial bombardments on the 21st of October of Kurdish rebel positions inside of northern Iraq. There's mounting pressure inside Turkey for intervention. On Saturday, Turkey's military commander was quoted as saying that Kurdish rebels would, quote, grieve with an intensity they cannot imagine, end of quote. However, Turkey, a close U.S. ally, appears in a holding pattern for now as the United States is fearful of destabilization in the only stable region in Iraq and is pushing for a diplomatic solution. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is slated to visit Turkey November 2nd and to attend a regional conference in Istanbul, while Turkey's Prime Minister Erdogan has plans to meet with President Bush on the 5th of November. The PKK, founded in 1974 and calling for a separate Kurdish state for the region's 30 million Kurds, took up arms against Turkey in 1984. The U.S., the EU, and NATO, as well as Turkey, have labeled it a terrorist organization. And the ongoing crisis there is fraught with danger and uncertainty. We want to discuss it in this opening hour. And first, we're going to go to Ankara and welcome Scott Peterson, who is Istanbul chief, bureau chief for the Christian Science Monitor. He also covers the Middle East. And welcome, Scott Peterson. Glad to have you with us. Are you there with us, Scott Peterson?
Yes, I am.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear you at first. Okay. Glad to have you with us. There's been a talk, especially in Turkey, about large-scale invasion, but fear that they would really get bogged down, particularly in the terrain and with the winter coming. What's the sentiment, as you're able to gauge it, in terms of diplomacy versus actually staging some kind of large-scale invasion?
Well, I think military is more aware than anybody else about the difficulties of actually crossing the border and moving into northern Iraq. And they've been across the border 24 separate times, and it really has been very, very difficult. It has been very, very difficult during those 24 previous cross-border operations. They've never actually succeeded in dislodging the PKK, and because of that, I think that they're very reluctant to go in this time. They are, however, banging the drum louder than they have at any point over the past decade, and what it really means is that they are serious about sending a message that Baghdad, Iraqi Kurds, or American forces must deal with this issue, and if they don't, they will feel that they have no choice but to move across themselves.
It just seems to be such intense nationalist fervor. We haven't seen anything like this since the conflict with Greece. And you've got a military commander talking about how they're going to grieve. One gets the sense that, especially with all these people protesting, that there's a tremendous upheaval there to go in.
Well, huge public demand for something to be done. And I think that that's one of the reasons you're hearing such powerful rhetoric coming from the generals, coming from the government. Nobody wants to be said that they're going to be the ones going to be soft on the PKK or on these Kurdish separatists. And so they are, I think one of the reasons why we're hearing that is because, one, they're giving warnings, of course, to the PKK, but I think they're also trying to salve the demands here locally because, I mean, it's not just the very large demonstrations and the very large military parades that we saw today, which, of course, is the 84th anniversary of the founding of the Turkish Republic, so a day in which, as you mentioned in your introduction, is a day of great nationalism anyway. But they really, I think, wanted to send a message that they're serious about dealing with this issue, that people are very, very tired of Turkey being constantly attacked. And even though the military knows that they are, that it's an imperfect solution for them to cross the border, I think what they're really trying to do is prize some action out of the U.S. and the Baghdad side.
What is your sense in Turkey of the response of the Kurds? There have been some gains, certainly under Prime Minister Erdogan, and now they're enabled to learn in their own language, private language courses, not state schools, and they're now also recipients of welfare plans. But the fact of the matter is that you've got millions of Kurds in Turkey. How are they responding to the PKK?
Well, I think that they are very nervous about the situation in the southeast. And it's interesting, but a few months ago, I spent quite a bit of time actually talking to Kurds down in the southeast. And, you know, there really was a lull in the action in terms of the fighting that took place starting in 1999 when Abdullah Öcalan, who was the leader of the PKK, was captured. He was captured in Kenya, brought back to Turkey. When he had his first showing in court, he made an incredible speech in which he basically told his people, you know, we need to do this within the, you know, we need to solve our problems peacefully and within the confines of the state, and we need to work with the state of Turkey to solve these problems, you know, basically saying, put down your weapons. And so the PKK for a couple of years really didn't do very much militarily, and at the same time, the government began to take quite a few, though modest, steps for Kurdish rights and ethnic identity elements. Things like, you know, certain things are recognized, as you say. I mean, you know, language in certain circumstances was allowed to be used, whereas in the past it wasn't allowed at all. And so, you know, there were some gains, but really what I found when I was there and speaking to numerous people down there was, and including government officials, I mean, they simply felt that the government didn't go far enough and didn't follow through enough with helping out that region, trying to overcome 15 years of very vicious fighting. And that's fighting both on the part of the PKK and also on the part of the reaction of the Turkish military and the forces. I mean, there were thousands of villages that were destroyed or cleared anyway, and also destroyed in the course of the fighting. And so really, it was a long way to come, and people feel that there just hasn't been enough done by the Turkish military. And then at the same time, now since we've had the American presence in Iraq since 2003, this has made it a lot easier for the PKK to reorganize themselves in northern Iraq, and for the faction of the PKK which are there, launch attacks again.
The launching of attacks, some feel, is an attempt to really draw in Turkey and get a war going on some scale, which, of course, puts the United States between a rock and a hard place, because they're allies with the Kurds, and they're also the United States, allies with Turkey. But the PKK's tactics in Iraq have created a lot of concern, because it's almost like the Sunni insurgents. I mean, it's hit and run, and small cells and mines and ambushes and C4s and IEDs, all those things that we associate with the Iraqi insurgency.
That's precisely right. In fact, analysts tell me all the time that they all those, exactly as you describe, all of those elements which didn't really play such an important role for the PKK in the 1980s and the 1990s in terms of their tactics, but that those really are what's being used commonly now. In fact, I mean, half of the Turkish soldiers who've been killed in the past year have died on landmines. And in the past, what there used to be would be much larger scale, much more conventional attacks. I mean, an attack of between 200 and 500 PKK fighters would take on a military post or a police station. You know, that's how the fight went. But now there's a kind of a much smarter insurgency going on the part of the PKK. And so, of course, the Turkish military are finding themselves as disadvantaged, if you will, as the American conventional force in Iraq feels when they're taking on the insurgents there. So it really has become a very vicious fight in that sense, and an insurgency that is just virtually impossible to be rid of militarily.
Turkey is really demanding Iraq turn over separatist rebels. It's really trying to pressure the United States to do something about these rebels, and certainly at this point the United States is trying to get Turkey to play the diplomacy card. How do you think this is all going to wash out?
I mean, we've got a rather small time frame, frankly, because it's not going to be long, probably just a few weeks before snow starts to fall on top of those mountains. It's going to slow things down a lot for all the forces that are involved. I think the Turkish military may breathe a sigh of relief. I mean, I don't think that they want to go in part because if they went in a large way, you know, while they would be seen to have been active, they have almost immediately problems trying to justify, you know, or how, you know, looking for an exit strategy that basically isn't going to be easy to find because they're not going to be able to leave large numbers of troops there. That's not very likely. And they also run the risk of confronting Iraqi Kurdish forces, which are quite strong, at least troublesome, for the Turkish military in northern Iraq, and they certainly know the territory better than the Turks. And also, of course, American forces are up there. Some of them are and can be moved very, very quickly. So it really is an uncertain situation. I think Turkey would much rather that somebody else dealt with this problem.
And the Kurdish entity government really unable to do anything about the PKK, though Turkey's pressing them?
I think that they have been turning a blind eye to the PKK for a variety of political reasons. I mean, yes, it's true. It wouldn't be easy to rid that area of the PKK, but it's also not entirely impossible. I mean, we mustn't forget, and Turks don't forget, that one of the KDP or one of the Kurdish factions in northern Iraq, if not both, were very helpful with the Turks in the late 1990s, actually hunting down and squeezing the PKK out of those areas. So there is a precedent for that. It depends on the political dynamic, and you know, that is probably the kind of help that the Turks would like to see. But they accuse one of those Kurdish factions, led by Masoud Barzani, the KDP. He's currently the president of that Kurdistan regional government, and they accuse him of allowing the PKK to have safe haven and being proactive in supporting the PKK as a card against Turkey.
Scott Peterson, Istanbul bureau chief for the Christian Science Monitor, who also covers the Middle East, with us from Ankara, and we thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Also, joining us for the hour, let me welcome Kevin McKernan, who is an independent journalist and filmmaker, the author of the book, The Kurds, A People in Search of Their Homeland. He's joining us this morning from Santa Barbara. Welcome, Kevin McKernan.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. We'll also say good morning to Aliza Marcus, who is an author and journalist, author of a new book called Blood and Belief, The PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence. She covered PKK in Turkey for over 8 years for Reuters, and she joins us this morning from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Aliza Marcus.
Thanks for having me.
Also, thank you. And we also want to welcome Cihan Tuval, who's assistant professor of sociology at UC Berkeley, and he joins us from Istanbul. And welcome, Cihan Tuval.
Thank you.
Glad to have you with us as well. Just from your perspective there in Istanbul, Cihan Tuval, what's the feeling you get about really what Turkey would like to do or what Turkey's going to do?
Well, things are not really very, you know, smooth and certain here because there are a lot of warring factions even within the state and sometimes even within the governing party. So it's really hard to come up with a prediction. But let me try to give you a sense of the balance of forces. So there is first the governing party, which got almost 47% of the votes in a highly fractured political climate, and the second party after it got only 20%. So it is really a representative party. And that party, the Justice and Development Party, or AKP, has been dragging its feet regarding a cross-border operation for almost a year now. The military has been pushing the party to go over the border, and the party has been resisting. But recently, the Prime Minister has started to swim with the tide, and he has started to give in to nationalist demands, both from the army and from the more nationalist parties on the right and on the left. So who is pushing Erdogan, the Prime Minister, in this direction? Well, behind the scenes, certainly the army, but also in the parliament, the Nationalist Action Party and the Republican People's Party, the founders of the republic, the Kemalists, the secular nationalists.
There are 20 Kurdish deputies in parliament. Are they having any effect with perhaps movement towards some kind of political solution?
Well, they have been trying to do that, but again, not very consistently, because just like the AKP is kind of divided within itself, the Democratic Society Party of the Kurds is much more divided than any other party in Turkey, probably. There are hawks and there are more peaceful Kurdish nationalists, and it's not very clear who is really in control of the party, but at this point the hawks might have more power. And for example, the more peaceful, moderate Kurdish nationalists are really trying to use the parliament and civil society to come up with a solution, but others in the party and in the parliament are, for example, going to the border, and they are declaring that the guerrilla is behind them and Iraqi Kurdistan is in front of them, giving the message that, that they are not really a party of Turkey, but of Kurdistan, first of all. So there are divisions in the party. So, you know, there are a lot of forces pulling the military in very different directions. And just like many of the key parties are divided, the military itself is also divided. Up till 2006, the military was under the control of more liberal and actually more pro-US forces. But that changed with the appointment of Yashar Büyükanıt, who is less liberal and more nationalist. But there is still a pro-US and liberal forces within the military, and they have been also trying to resist nationalist temptations.
We should mention that Yashar Büyükanıt is the military commander I alluded to earlier, who said that the Kurdish rebels will grieve with an intensity they cannot imagine. That was a rhetoric he was quoted as using over the weekend. What about, I'm reading that as many as a third of the Turkish Kurds support the PKK?
Well, it's really hard to come up with an exact number, but I can tell you at least that the number has been dropping in the last few years with AKP's, the governing party's, opening to the Kurds. In the 1980s and 1990s, the Kurds were divided between secular nationalism of the PKK and the Democratic Society Party's predecessors in those decades, and a more Islamist line. And there were also Kurds voting for the center-right and even for the far nationalist right in Turkey. But what happened in the 21st century, in the beginning of the 21st century, was that all the rightist forces lost ground except the Islamists. So the Justice and Development Party, actually, which is no longer an Islamist party, but a more Islamically conservative party, rather, now represents the right in Kurdish areas in Turkey. And when you look at the 2002 elections, these two parties basically share the ground. So the more secular nationalism-oriented Kurds vote for the Democratic Society Party or its predecessors, and the others, the more pious and conservative Kurds, vote for the Justice and Development Party. But now, in the 2007 elections, the AKP has really swept off basically any other party but the Democratic Society Party, the votes of which have also dropped to almost a third of the Kurdish votes in the region.
This is Cihan'tu Ahal, by the way, again, assistant professor of sociology at UC Berkeley, who's with us from Istanbul. And Lisa Marcus, author of a new book, Blood and Belief, the PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence, is with us from Washington. Lisa Marcus, excuse me, you were in a PKK camp in Turkey. What's your sense of the support of the PKK in Turkey, the Kurds in Turkey, for the PKK?
Well, I would agree with Cihan in that support for the PKK, active support for the PKK, has declined. But I think we need to make some distinctions here. While the PKK is no longer as popular as it was in the 1990s, certainly, it remains very strong, and it essentially controls the direction of the Kurdish political debate inside Turkey. It exerts a very strong influence over the Kurdish political party that has politicians in parliament, and it essentially can set the tone of what's happening for Kurds by fighting, basically. At the same time, I think there is a great deal of respect for the rebels. I mean, it can be a grudging respect, but many people have relatives who had fought in the PKK, died in that fight. Maybe they were imprisoned by Turkey for Kurdish activism, not even pro-PKK Kurdish activism. And what this means is that people have a certain respect for the fighters. It's difficult to break them off completely from the PKK, even if they don't want to give active support to the organization anymore.
You were quoted in today's New York Times as saying that essentially the PKK doesn't want to be sidelined, that that's what's driven them since 2004.
Yes, I think that's a big factor in what they're doing. In 2003, after the U.S. invasion and the Iraqi Kurds began building up a Kurdish mini-state, I think many Turkish Kurds started to look at Iraqi Kurdistan as sort of an example of what they would like. Many of them have expressed a great deal of support for Barzani. Again, not active support, but they respect him as a Kurdish leader. The PKK realized it was losing ground. It had declared a ceasefire after the capture of their leader, Abdullah Öcalan, in 1999, who's now in a Turkish prison. And since then, there had been very little movement by the Turkish government to address the Kurdish political issue. True, the Turkish government made some cultural changes. They allowed limited Kurdish education in private schools for people over 18. They allowed limited broadcasting 4 hours a week in Kurdish. But this really was seen by Kurds as too little, too late. And it was done in such a grudging fashion, this is again from the Kurdish perspective, that people were ready for something again, and they were unhappy. And I think the PKK decided to try to capitalize on this. And at the same time, it wanted to show that it was relevant. It didn't want to disappear like any organization. It wants to be part of what's going on. So it started fighting again in 2004, and this has really boosted its profile, as we can see now. Everybody's talking about the PKK.
Eliza Marcus, again with us from Washington, is the author of a new book, Blood and Belief, The PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence. And Kevin McKernan's an independent journalist and filmmaker, author of the book, The Kurds, A People in Search of Their Homeland. He's with us from Santa Barbara this morning. The EU, I notice, has been urging Turkey to offer amnesty. Is that having any effect, Kevin McKernan?
Well, no, not so far. In fact, this has come up before. About a year ago, Jalal Talabani, the Kurdish-born, he's a Kurd president of Iraq, played a behind-the-scenes role in arranging a PKK ceasefire. This was in October of 2006, and the PKK said at that time, it was reported, that they might hand over weapons to U.S. forces in exchange for amnesty and other Turkish concessions. That didn't happen, and it doesn't look as if it's going to happen now.
Under a worst-case scenario, if Turkey was to go in, it could certainly not only draw in Iraq and Iran, possibly, Syria, the United States. I mean, this is a pretty high-stake geopolitical game we're talking about here, isn't it?
Well, very much so. In some ways, we're just a bomb away from some rather large incursion like that. At this point, Turkey has significant bargaining chips with Washington, and you mentioned the visit by Rice and then the visit of the Turkish Prime Minister to the White House. But the situation on the ground is growing more and more grim, you might say. If you take a look at this area where the PKK has its major headquarters, it's a very rugged area. It's called Mount Kandil. And I've been in these camps before and after the U.S. invasion, and it's an area that straddles the Iraq-Iran border. It's long been a haven for guerrillas, not just the PKK, and it's got hundreds of bomb-resistant caves that really honeycomb the slopes on both sides of the border, Iran and Turkey. And in fact, you might say it's a kind of small mountain because on the eastern slopes, you have Pajak, the PKK Iranian equivalent, a group reportedly that receives U.S. aid.
Kevin, forgive me. Hold that thought. We're going to have to go to a break here, but I want to give out our phone number, too. Any of you who are interested in talking with us, making comments here or bringing up questions, you're welcome to join us. Our toll-free line is 866-733-6786, and we welcome your calls. Again, it's toll-free from wherever you're listening to us, 866-733-6786, or send an email. The email address is forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the ongoing volatile situation between Turkey and Kurdish rebels, which unfortunately has been escalating. Looking at the history of the tensions and asking what's at stake for the United States, we talked earlier with Scott Peterson, Istanbul Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and we have with us for the hour Cihan Tuval, who's Assistant Professor of Sociology at UC Berkeley, who's with us from Istanbul, and Eliza Marcus, author and journalist, author of a new book called Blood and Belief, The PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence. She covered the PKK in Turkey for over 8 years for Reuters and is with us from Washington. Kevin McKiernan is with us from Santa Barbara, and he's an independent journalist and filmmaker and the author of the book, The Kurds, A People in Search of Their Homeland. Your calls and emails are welcome, and you can join us whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite by calling us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or emailing us forum@kqed.org. And we had to go to a break there. We're going to go to your calls and emails forthwith. But Kevin McKiernan, you were talking about just the rough terrain up there and how Iraqi, Turkish, and Iranian Kurdish nationalists, they're all kind of right there up in those caves.
Well, it's a very complex area, isn't it? The Iranian counterpart of the PKK, which their unconfirmed reports receive aid from the CIA, have their camps on the Iranian side of the mountain, and the Turkish Kurds on the western, on the Iraq side of the mountain. You might say, if it's there's some irony here, good Kurds and bad Kurds, good Kurds fighting Iran and bad Kurds fighting Turkey. And the same mountain, I should say, was also home to Iraqi President Jalal Talabani when he himself was a guerrilla fighting Saddam's troops, and Saddam was unable to dislodge him from that mountain. And finally, Ansar al-Islam, the al-Qaeda affiliate, also used Kandil as a sanctuary. So it's got a long history of harboring guerrillas, and I think it's going to be very difficult, especially with the snow that reportedly is falling at higher altitudes, to dislodge the PKK, at least in this season.
What do you see as the United States' stake in all this? I mean, for example, Iran probably looks at an autonomous Kurdish state as being against their interests, I would imagine. And
Very much so.
But what about the U.S.?
Well, I think that the U.S. is caught between allies here. It's a very difficult situation. Today in London, the Iraqi Foreign Minister Hoshyar Zebari said, look, you want us to hand over the PKK leaders. We simply don't have the means to do it. They're armed. And if Turkey, in fact, invades, there will be a disaster here. You're asking us for something we can't do. And furthermore, when Iraqi leaders flew to Ankara last week, according to Zebari, Turkey was unresponsive to any other solution but a military one.
Well, if there were a military strike, Eliza Marcus, you'd have a security zone. Presumably, Turks are fearful that they'd have a situation very much like Lebanon with a kind of Hezbollah in Israel.
It's exactly the danger for Turkey. As long as they stay more or less on their side of the border and shell from the air, shell from tanks, and maybe send in small amounts of ground troops, it's not really a big problem. But should they send in, let's say, those 100,000 troops that they have massed on the border, and go deep into northern Iraq and try to carve out a security zone, then they have potential problems because, for one, the Iraqi Kurds will be very unhappy about this, and they've talked about fighting to protect their territorial integrity. And that's something that Turkey could get drawn into, just like Israel had problems in Lebanon. Turkey could face a lot of casualties. There could be clashes that cause civilian deaths that really hurt Turkey internationally as well.
There seems to be little influence in northern Iraq of the Iraqi government, let alone the Kurdish regional government.
Well, certainly the Iraqi government has almost no influence over northern Iraq. And the Kurdistan regional government, while it's very tightly in control of that region, has very little influence over the PKK. It's true that the Iraqi Kurds allowed the PKK to settle in those mountains, but they allowed them back in 1983. So the PKK has really been there for a long time, and they've set themselves up very well. And I think, as Kevin said, the Iraqi Kurds use those very mountains to stage their own battles, and they know how difficult it is to push anybody out of there. At the same time, I think the Iraqi Kurds don't want to be seen as fighting on Turkey's behalf. Turkey has not established direct relations with the Kurdistan regional government. It doesn't want to meet with Barzani, the leader of the Kurdistan regional government. And from their perspective, why should they fight on behalf of a country that has not viewed them quite as an ally?
Gian Tuol, if I can go to you for a moment, there's a talk about eight Turkish soldiers being held, possibly being released by the PKK. What's your sense of that?
Yes, the PKK has actually done this before in the 1990s. The goal was really opening up some diplomatic channels through Kurdish parliamentarians. And that didn't work out, actually, in the 1990s, because the Kurdish parliamentarians and the human rights organizations, which actually helped those soldiers return to Turkey, were blamed afterwards with helping the PKK. So no independent party is really going to be willing to act as a bridge, I think, in this situation. So for now, nothing is happening, and I don't think there will be a major opening as a result of these captured soldiers. But let me state something else, which is, I think, very important in regards of the Turkish army. I agree with Eliza that the PKK does not want to be sidelined, and another party that does not want to be sidelined is the Turkish army. And this again goes back partially back to the political situation in Turkey. The Justice and Development Party is basically clearing off the ground from any other political parties and political forces. And the Republican People's Party, as well as the far nationalist right and the army, feel that they are really losing Turkey to conservative Islam. So the extreme reaction from the establishment is partially a reaction to the Justice and Development Party, not only to the PKK, not only to the emergent Kurdish state, but also to the political situation in Turkey. And again, that is one of the reasons of division within the Turkish military, because there are now forces in the minority who think that the Turkish Republic can live with conservative Islam, but Yashar Bukanat and his associates do not think so. And in the parliament, the Republican People's Party and the Nationalist Action Party give voice to this concern, and actually they see the Justice and Development Party, the governing party, almost as traitors who allow the emergence of a Kurdish state in northern Iraq, which they think will end up dividing Turkey in the longer run.
I want to go to our callers, and again, that's Cihan Tuval, who's assistant professor of sociology at UC Berkeley, with us this morning from Istanbul, and you can be with us as well. In fact, I want to go to your calls. Before I do, a couple of emails. Kevin McKiernan, this is a listener named Dan, who says, since they are also present in Syria and Iran, is the PKK launching incursions from these countries into Turkey? And if not, why not? Would Turkey send troops into these countries?
Well, I think one of the ironies of the fighting in the 1990s was that the Syrian Kurds were disproportionately represented in the PKK. And I once was in Syria and asked some Kurdish people, how could this be so? Why don't you stage an uprising against Syria? And they said, Syria's flat. There are mountains in Turkey. It's as simple as that. And we look at it as a chance for a pan-Kurdish solution to bring together this age-old dream, the four countries where Kurdish populations exist.
Another question from a listener named Tristan, who says, Turkey has supported the U.S. and NATO in Afghanistan, contributing some 900 troops. Why haven't they declared Article 5 of NATO? An attack on one is an attack on all against the PKK in Iraq. Kevin McKiernan again?
Well, this is such a complex situation. I think that the point that's been made today, which more than any other, is the number of factions on all sides and how that doesn't make such a monolithic solution possible. I mean, look, when Öcalan was captured, the PKK leader in 99, and then from a Turkish jail cell ordered his fighters to go out of the country to retreat and go to Iraq. At that time, 99 and the year 2000, even 2001, the Iraqi Kurds did fight the PKK. And when you go up to this area where their headquarters are now on the Iranian border, you see a big graveyard with PKK fighters. And they say to you, all right, we get along fine with the Iraqi Kurds now, but we planted our dead here, and we're not going to move. This is our area, too.
We could see possibly Turkey shutting down electricity or imposing economic sanctions, could we not?
Oh, I think so. I mean, during the 1990s, you have to remember that Barzani and Talabani both fought on the side of Turkey against the PKK. After
similar tremendous pressure was brought to bear.
We're going to go to our callers. Let's begin, Ed, with you. Good morning.
Hi. Great show. I've heard a report that the Kurdish government in the north has said that they would be happy to work with Turkey on the PKK problem if the Turks would be willing to talk to them directly and not simply make demands in Baghdad.
Cihan Tuval?
Yes, actually, Eliza already touched on this. The Turkish government, let's not say the Turks, the Turkish government and the Turkish state do not want to recognize the Kurdish regional government. And, you know, that's one of the main problems in the situation, because the central Iraqi government has no control over the region, and the only authority that has control is not recognized by Turkey. So a diplomatic solution is really, really hard as long as Turkey does not recognize the Kurdish authorities. And again, let me break down the government, the word government. Actually, there are a lot of people within the government who want to be on fine terms with the Kurdish authorities in the north of Iraq. But if they do that, they could even be pushed out of the parliament. So it's not really easy for them to take such a bold step.
Let me thank the caller, and I'm going to go to more of your calls. First, let me go back to Eliza Marcus. I'm wondering, because of all the controversy, Eliza Marcus, over genocide as an indictment against the Turkish government with respect to the Armenian people and their unwillingness, of course, to, well, admit that, concede that, whatever you will call it, this has similar resonance with the Kurds, does it not?
Well, I think that for the Kurds, that the issue with the Kurds does have some similarities. Obviously, it's an issue of recognizing history, being open about talking about history, because similarly to the fact that Turkey doesn't like to discuss what happened to the Armenians and has actively worked against this resolution, there's still a certain reluctance to really address freely the Kurdish issue in Turkey, the history of Kurds, their complaints, their political aspirations. But I think right now it's really, one is a question of history with the Armenians, and one is a question of day-to-day politics with the Kurds. And Turkey does have an opportunity to talk to Kurds. There are Kurdish politicians in the parliament, as Cihan talked about. There's Kurdish activists. And they really do have people they could sit down and talk with. And there are some openings. There are conferences that go on. People speak much more freely. There are books. But
there's a conference going on that Secretary of State Rice is going to be attending in a few days.
Right, and I mean also the Kurdish history conferences in Istanbul that discuss Kurdish complaints. But yet it's all done very much superficially. And I think there's a real reluctance on this part of the Turkish government to address either the Armenian issue or the Kurdish issue, clearly.
And we'll have our listeners join us. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having this great show. My question really goes to recent history. From the American point of view, I'm still incredulous that the Bush administration started that war in Iraq, knowing all these various, every border of Iraq had something akin to what's going on with Turkey and the PKK. That we were going to stumble into. And could some of the guests just go back over what the Bush administration was thinking when they thought that Turkey was going to allow us to send our troops into northern Iraq through Turkey, and how the fact that they turned the U.S. down played out with the relations between our support for the Kurds in the north and the Turkish fear of, you know, a base for the PKK. I'm not clear about what our politicians were thinking about all that, because it just seems like, just from the cursory amount that I know, it was really a very misguided idea.
Well, one can only speculate in terms of reading their minds back then, but Eliza Marcus, it's pretty clear from this perspective, and you're in Washington, that this administration thought it was going to get a lot more cooperation from the Turkish government and a lot more alliance from the Turkish government.
It did. It was really counting on the Turkish parliament to approve a resolution to allow Turkish troops through Turkey, U.S. troops through Turkey, and to use that northern front. The Turkish parliament, though, much to everybody's surprise, I have to say even mine as well, voted against this. And I think that's when the problems really started. Turkey's a democracy. It had every right to vote this down. The U.S. then reacted very angrily against Turkey, which started these sort of rocky relations between Turkey and the United States. Turkish public opinion has been very anti-U.S. Polls show something like 80% distrust the U.S., 90%, I think. And the United States government didn't make this any easier. In 2003, 2004, there were a lot of nasty comments about Turkey, sort of resentful comments. And then with this Armenian resolution that passed the House Foreign Relations Committee a few weeks ago, this only confirmed, I think, for many people in Turkey that the United States is taking an oppositionist view towards Turkey and is not a country that can work with Turkey.
Some questions from listeners, and Kevin McKernan, perhaps you can answer Tina's question here. She wants to know, are Turkish Kurds on the whole more or less religions Islamist than the Turkish population?
Well, most of them are moderate Sunnis, and I would say a large number are somewhat ceremonial Muslims. That is, they'd go to the mosque for a funeral or a marriage or something like that. I wondered if I could follow up a little bit on the point that's just been made, though, about the Turkish-American relationship and how it became frayed. I was in northern Iraq, and I happened to be interviewing just before and after and during the war, but just before the war when the news came down from Washington, I was interviewing a Turkish leader, and there were a couple in the room, and he just got a telephone call that General Myers had slammed the phone down with his Turkish counterpart after getting this news that deployment would be prevented. And the Kurdish leaders I was with just whooped for joy and gave each other high fives. So that's a little bit of an insight on the different perspectives about this.
Another listener sends the following question. Listener's name is Farzam. He says, I'm wondering if the guests could comment further on the activities of the PKK in the region, meaning activities of PKK or other Kurdish separatist groups in Turkey and also in Iran, which greatly increases the potential for regional conflict. There are reports, although not reported widely, about PKK raids also into Iran and Iran retaliation. Also, could your guest comment further on the U.S. role in funding groups in that region? As I understand, these groups, PKK and other Kurdish separatists, are somewhat knit, and is it possible that some of the fundings are being diverted from one group to another? What do you know on that score, Kevin McKernan?
Well, I think some of that is certainly true. Both the Turks and Iranians have shelled this same mountain, Mount Kandil, which is the headquarters of both the Iranian and Turkish separatists. So, indeed, this is true, and I think that there's been some swapping of weapons and so forth, and the Turks have complained that in raiding Kurdish camps, both along the border and deep inside Turkey, where there are incidentally camps, and this raises the question about whether all of the recent problems have come from cross-border raids. The Turkish military has found American weapons, and this was an earlier controversy this year. Where did these American weapons come from? And so this further complicates it. I think, you know, though, when you look at Iraqi Kurds, they're very friendly with Turkish business interests. Turkey is the major investor in northern Iraq. And, you know, on the worldwide market, oil prices would go through the roof if such an invasion took place, maybe $110 or higher. But this would also be very bad for both Turkish business interests and for Iraqi Kurdish business interests.
By the way, oil is going up as we speak, and some are attributing it to this crisis, among a few others that are popping around us.
I mean, it's amazing, though, to see the Turkish investment now in northern Iraq. When this crisis first came up, the Turkish lira took a dive of something like 3 or 4%, and economists predict it would get worse if the invasion took place. But, you know, there's some 27-story resort hotels in northern Iraq now, and Turkish money is very much involved in that part of the world. So this is not going to be a picnic if such an invasion takes place.
We go to more of your calls in Armri. Thank you for waiting. Hi.
Hi, sir. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
So I was born and raised in Istanbul. For my life, I've been living in Barrier in about like 4.5 years. So what I was going to, it's not actually a question. What I was going to tell you is the the people who are talking on the radio or on the news or anywhere like that, they're always talking about, like, rebels. What I was going to tell you is, like, they're not actually rebels. They're, like, terrorists. That's, like, I was thinking about it. So what I was going to ask you is if I'm going to say the Al-Qaeda rebels, what are you going to say about it?
That's an interesting semantic distinction. I think, obviously, you know, it's like the old line, one person's terrorist is another person's liberation. But they have been labeled terrorists. And Jihan Tual, the EU has labeled them terrorists. That is, we're talking about the PKK now, the United States, Turkey, and NATO, for that matter. So it would certainly be at ease calling them terrorists, wouldn't we?
This is a very important question, a very important point. This is a very complex issue. The U.S. has actually been on the side of Turkey for 15 years in fighting the PKK. So for the U.S., the PKK were terrorists. For the EU, it's a more mixed matter because, for example, as Germany was selling tanks to Turkey, some German firms were, of course, illegally selling arms to the PKK. And, you know, there are other levels to this issue, too. So you already stated it. Whether you call the PKK terrorists depends on your political position. But even if you try to come up with an objective definition, if such a thing is possible, it's really hard to do because if you go back to the old definition of terrorism by the UN and what separates a terrorist group from a guerrilla group, there are, of course, many criteria, but for our purposes, very important three criteria were civilian support, which the PKK had, and no chance of diplomatic, political, and civilian solutions, which certainly was the case in Turkey in the 1980s and 1990s, and I don't think it is any longer the case exactly. And the third thing that really complicates the issue is that what separates a terrorist organization from a guerrilla organization is that the primary targets for a guerrilla organization are security forces. And for a terrorist organization, there is more emphasis on attacks against civilians.
But the caller also made a distinction or an analogy to Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda doesn't necessarily represent any kind of rebellion against the nationality. It's, you know, there are Al-Qaeda insurgents in Iraq, but it would be incorrect to say that Al-Qaeda are rebels, but it would not probably be incorrect, and it isn't incorrect, for journalists to call PKK rebels.
Yes, and well, let me conclude my thought regarding this third point. So the PKK really attacked both civilians and the security forces. So based on this old definition of the UN, it was somewhere in between a terrorist organization and a guerrilla organization. But after 9/11, actually, the definition of terrorism has changed. And when you look at the current definition, the PKK would fall more in line with the category of a terrorist. But who knows how this definition is going to change in 20 years. I mean, it has been fluctuating.
Well, you also mentioned the United Nations, and one of our listeners, Craig, asks, doesn't the United Nations have a nonviolent process in place to help people like the Kurds who want to form their own independent nation or country, some kind of sovereignty, so that the area doesn't break down into a big civil war? Do any of our guests know if there's any kind of process involved in that in the United Nations?
I think there
Eliza
is.
Eliza Marcus? Yeah.
I think there is some sort of process, but I think that you need some sort of approval from the host state as well. It's not so simple that any minority can just come to the United States and apply to be a state. You know, and like many of these things, it's also very theoretical. And working out in practice hasn't really, as far as I know, been put to the test.
As you say, so many of these things. Let me go to Larry in Alameda, who wants to ask about the Al-Qaeda influence of the PKK. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I'm not necessarily want to ask about the influence of them. My question is, Al-Qaeda has been pushed around in the rest of Iraq, and what's the chance of them deciding, okay, let's destabilize the most stable point by drawing in Turkey through claiming that we're the PKK, And I doubt very much if Turkey would ever believe that it wasn't the PKK, and therefore destabilize it and help their own cause.
Kevin McKernan?
Well, it's possible because, but I don't think it's likely. It's possible because...
They're using all of the tactics of the insurgents in Iraq, actually. Aren't
yes, they? And, you know, the PKK, the atheist PKK and the fundamentalist Al-Qaeda are oil and water, and it's unlikely that this would ever happen.
Of course, they said that about Saddam Hussein and and Al-Qaeda, too, and this administration took a very different line on that, as we
well know. Well, certainly it's true, and it would be a political victory for the PKK if Turkey pulls the trigger and crosses the border, because the Iraqi Kurds, they've long wanted the Iraqi Kurds to be on their side against Turkey, and this is likely to happen.
Well, we're going to have to constantly monitor this because it is such a serious ongoing crisis, and I'm glad that we found so much information from our guests, and I want to thank them all, those guests who are with us this morning. Scott Peterson, we spoke with earlier at the beginning of the program. He's Istanbul Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor and joined us from Ankara. We had Cihan Tuval from UC Berkeley, who's Assistant Professor of Sociology there, with us from Istanbul this morning. We thank him. And also Eliza Marcus, an author and journalist. Her new book is Blood and Belief, The PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence. She covered the PKK in Turkey for over 8 years for Reuters and was with us from Washington, D.C. Kevin McKernan with us this morning, also from Santa Barbara, the author of The Kurds, A People in Search of Their Homeland, and an independent journalist and filmmaker. Another hour of Forum coming your way. In the hour ahead, we're going to find out all about international students and who they are and what they're all about, and we have 10 times as many here as we have anywhere else in the world. We'll speak with some, as well as some people who have some insight into why numbers are going up in terms of international students. I want to thank our guests, thank you, our listeners, and thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Dave Freeman is our engineer. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.